Good morning. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
They've left us up.
Could maybe council.
They've left up their.
Yes, it's distracting.
Can you move aside while
sure.
they try to
no
extricate what they have installed? Thank you.
Well, I do enjoy the high tech stuff.
Thank you.
Good morning.
All right, excuse me.
May it please the court. Zach Mosner, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Washington. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes. First, I'd like to apologize to the court for an apparent misstatement in the reply brief, which I'd like to make quick reference to and otherwise address later in the proceeding, unless the court wants me to immediately address it now. On page 9 of our reply brief, in an extraneous comment, I indicate in reference to a tax decision that it, if it matters, the opinion not on point factually has been withdrawn. There was every intention to withdraw the decision, but in fact, it has not been withdrawn, and I don't want to mislead the court. But otherwise, we've distinguished this in the brief, and I can address this later on. I think I've been asked to.
You were asked to address
yes.
this determination.
Happy to do so now.
You don't have to. You can do it in the context of your argument.
Yes.
But it is, as we understand it, a determination of the Department of Revenue?
It's an advisory opinion, yes. It's of record. And I'll tell you what
does WTD mean?
It's a Washington tax decision. So this decision is available in two places. You could find it on a docket number 11-0227
yeah, right.
or at 31 WTD 57.
That's how they direct us to cite it?
I believe so.
All right, and you were saying it's an advisory opinion?
Yes, it is. And in fact, you'll see that in the where it's all listed, excise tax advisories are interpretive statements authorized by RCW 34.05230, and that appears on the Department of Revenue tax page on the Internet where you'll see these various decisions actually posted.
All right, thank you.
So again, I apologize for that. This is an issue that stems from a general receivership sale of property free and clear of liens in Superior Court, King County.
Right.
And it is strictly governed by statute. 7.60 is the receivership statute. It's promulgated some 11 years ago with a collaborative effort of the debtor-creditor bar. The issue here before the court today is something involving real estate excise tax, which for those of us who are old enough in the old days used to actually involve the appending of stamps to a real estate transaction, which was required before the auditor would actually record a conveyance of a deed. Nowadays, it's an electronic transfer, but it's a tax. The issue before the court is whether or not the court below erred in granting a real estate excise tax exemption, meaning holding it free from tax under RCW 8245-0103 subpart dotted I. The only four bases for an exemption set forth in that statute are for sales in a mortgage, foreclosure-related proceeding, deed of trust, lien foreclosure, or upon execution of a judgment. Let me say that each one of those proceedings is occupied by the field in that it is strictly a statute that governs what those processes are. I know that you'll find in the reply to our position, and then in our reply too, we dealt with this Webster definition for the sake of argument, but our actual position is you don't look to definitions because the statutes strictly occupy the field. The court in this case, the court below, said that, well, a receivership feels a lot like and looks a lot like a judgment and a lot like an execution of a judgment. That discretion is not to the court because statutes like this are strictly interpreted. Exemptions, and this is a body of case law that's aptly dealt with in the brief, exemptions are jealously guarded by the legislature and by the case law that it's followed and may only be given under the appropriate circumstances where it is clear. Now, insofar as what you do have, the enforcement of judgment section is at 6.17. And I point the court to the obvious fact that the legislature, when it created the receivership bill, did not put the receivership bill in the enforcement of judgments section. It appears in the 7 section, and there's a very clear reason why. The legislature readily distinguishes the two, and so you have a combination of cumulative circumstances and statutes that show the court erred in taking this quantum leap.
If we look at WTD 57, are we looking at it for persuasive authority? And how do you distinguish it?
You say basically that we're looking at everything here today de novo because this is purely a legal issue.
Well, I know, but what weight do we give
none,
to the determination?
And I'll tell you why.
Why?
The same erroneous statement in my brief at page 9 is preceded by the cite to AgriLink Foods. And AgriLink basically tells you that where the language is clear, that a prior tax advisory opinion is not to be used by this court of appeal or any court of appeal. That has been amplified by Tesoro Refining, which apologetically is not in the brief, but Tesoro Refining versus Department of Revenue at 173 Washington 2nd, 551, in particular 557 and 8, says very clearly, based on AgriLink Foods, however, we glean legislative intent from the text of the statute, regardless of incidental and contrary agency interpretations. That's abundantly clear. So I agree with this court. You have before you today a tax advisory opinion that says everything I don't want it to say.
Right.
But it's not binding on this court. In fact, both AgriLink and Tesoro tell you that. And I'm here to say don't look at the decision because it's wrong in every regard.
Can I ask?
Yes.
I'm a little confused. And Wiley was the original one. There's a clear indication it was unpublished. Why didn't it remain unpublished then, if you think it's all wrong?
I really don't know. I'm not familiar with that process, and I don't participate in that type of law. I show up for trials and appeals mostly in federal court. So I don't
have a problem.
Yes.
With you telling us don't rely on this because even though we withdrew the original one and then substituted it with the persuasive one.
Well, right.
I think it's at best persuasive but not controlling.
I think
you tell me it's all wrong.
Well, it is wrong. Now, look, I can deal with the facts if you think it would be instructive or useful to the court. But again, I think that it didn't even involve a general receivership. It didn't involve a sale free and clear. And so it is off factually. I'm sorry, I'm proceeding as if, is it okay to continue?
Well, do you want to use some of your rebuttal time?
I'll wait till rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is John Knapp, and I represent the FDIC, which is the plaintiff and the judgment creditor in this case, and is the party that obtained the appointment of the receiver. The receiver specific Realty Advisors, LLC, appointed as an agent of the court.
One of the arguments they make is that, and they make it more than once, is that the receiver is acting on behalf of the debtor. And that relates to their argument about what execution of a judgment means.
I don't think that's a correct interpretation of the law. The receivership statute says that the receiver is an
agent. Well,
that
is what they argue, though, isn't it?
That's their argument. The receivership statute.
Okay, so why is that wrong?
It's wrong because the definition of a receiver under the receivership statute is an agent of the court. That's also reflected in the tax decision. It's recognized that a receiver is an agent of the court. The receiver was appointed to seize and take control of and sell the property of the debtor, but it is not a standing in the shoes of the debtor in the same sense that it's a stand-in for the debtor. It's an agent for the court who's been appointed by an order of the court, subject to the supervision and approval of the court, to take control of the assets and sell them.
So this was a stipulated judgment. It was secured by deeds of trust. Is that correct? But the dispute under this particular exemption seems to turn on upon execution of a judgment. So is that all we should look at, even though the judgment was secured by a deed of trust?
Well, I think our primary argument is upon execution of a judgment.
That seems to be what the argument is.
Yes. The receiver was appointed. One of the grounds, excuse me, for appointment of the receiver was that it was to give effect to a judgment. That's one of the statutory grounds for appointment of a receiver. And according to the Supreme Court's standard for statutory interpretation, in order to look at the plain language, you look to the dictionary definition.
So just so that I understand procedurally what happened, and it wasn't clear to me from the limited record we had, what was filed in King County Superior Court? Was it an action to enforce the stipulated judgment?
So the judgment was entered in Clark County Superior Court, and then the plaintiff, at that time it was Cowlitz Bank, which was subsequently taken over by the FDIC, recorded the judgment or abstracts of judgment in various counties, so including King County. Snohomish County was another one of the counties.
So when you when you record an abstract of judgment, I mean, is there any cause of action related to that?
Well, it gives you a case number to commence execution, an execution process.
Okay.
And so there are many different ways to go about executing on a judgment. One is to get a writ of execution. One is to get a receiver appointed. The concept is the same according to the dictionary definition.
So once you had that cause number, that's why you then filed the motion with the Superior Court to appoint a receiver.
That's right. So the judgment was basically brought here to King County, and since it was here, that was a basis to seek appointment of a receiver in King County.
And just because I don't understand, I mean, this is not an area where I'm an expert, FDIC is both the receiver and the successor in interest.
Well, FDIC is a receiver for Cowlitz Bank under federal law. So in the context here, the receiver is Pacific Realty Advisors, which is the agent of the Superior Court.
You're just the successor in interest
we're
of the
successor
judgment
in interest.
For the purposes of executing the judgment.
Yes, yeah, so assignee of the judgment.
Okay. All right.
Just by operation of the law.
The statutory interpretation issue that we're faced with then, is it this simple that the department contends that execution has to mean pursuant to the statute that allows sheriffs to or directs them to execute judgments, whereas your argument is that it has a broader meaning that includes you?
Yes, that's right, Your Honor. The excise tax exemption statute just refers to upon execution of a judgment. It doesn't say limit it to a writ of execution. It says execution. There's no definition in the excise tax statute for execution.
So if I understood the department's argument, they feel that because there is a rule that says that exemptions are to be strictly construed, I think, against the taxpayer and in favor of the department, that means that execution should be given its narrowest possible meaning, which according to them is the sheriff only gets to do it.
I think that's what they're trying to say. They're saying you should take a term that's undefined and give it its narrowest possible definition as opposed to entitling that word to all the definitions that are available in the dictionary. With respect to the cases that deal with narrowly construing whether there's an exemption or not, one is the City of Spokane case, and there wasn't actually an exemption for the City of Spokane available, so they weren't entitled to an exemption. There actually has to be an exemption, for one thing. And then the Bellis case is another case where it talks about how to narrowly construe exemptions, and it just says, well, in that situation, there was a way of valuing real property, and there were constitutional problems with it because there needed to be uniformity of taxation. So, except if there's an exemption. So the parties on appeal tried to say, well, this is really an exemption. It's not really a way of valuing the property. It's just an exemption. But there wasn't actually anything in the exemption statute that said anything about this kind of situation.
So here you have this word execution, and you are wanting to give it a dictionary definition. They're claiming it's limited to the sheriff. Is there any relationship in the statutes, structurally or otherwise, between the statute that we're looking at, NRCW 82, and the statute, wherever it is, I forget, that talks about the sheriff going out and executing on judgments?
There's no cross-reference, Your Honor,
That's
between the excise tax exemption and the execution statute 6.17. So you're left with an undefined term in the excise tax statute. So you start by looking at the dictionary definition. We think the dictionary definition is broad enough to encompass execution in many different forms, whether it's through getting a writ of execution or going to the Superior Court, getting an order of the Superior Court to say this receiver is appointed to take control of the property and sell it.
What are the policy considerations here, if any? I mean, I have
wondered whether the department is suggested or suggesting or arguing that somehow this is an opening of the floodgates, that this is an innocuous-looking issue, but if we rule against them, tax revenues are going to go down, people are going to abuse this, it's going to be exploited, et cetera. I mean, they haven't said that, I don't think, but one kind of infers that they're there to guard the state's revenues and make sure that people don't start, you know, broadening loopholes and avoiding taxes that they should have to pay. So are you a stalking horse for, people want to broaden that real estate excise tax exemption?
No, we just want to enforce the policy of the exemption, which is to have an exemption where there are secured creditors' rights that are being enforced. If you look through the common theme of the types of contexts where the exemption is available, it's a deed of trust. It's a mortgage, deed, or trust, or lien foreclosure proceeding. It's execution of a judgment, which creates a judgment lien.
So it's a forced situation.
It's an involuntary situation where the creditor has to do something to enforce its rights as a secured creditor, and it's pouring salt in the wounds to that secured creditor if it had to pay the excise tax. Eventually,
we're just an arm's length sale.
Mm-hmm. It's under the supervision of the court.
What about their argument that the definition of seller includes the receiver, and therefore this section cannot apply to a receivership?
Yeah, so with respect, the seller sort of says who is at first going to be looked at to be tagged with this tax, but then sellers are the ones who have the right to claim exemption. So a receiver may well be a seller within the definition, but then the receiver is a seller who's also entitled to look to the exemptions and then claim them. I don't think that because you're defined as a seller means you can't claim any exemptions, then nobody would be able to claim any exemptions because everybody who's defined as a seller would have to pay the tax and wouldn't have a choice. Instead, they have the ability to claim those exemptions.
They also make an argument about construing the statute the way you're arguing would result in absurd results, and I think that does factor into what Judge Becker's just been mentioning, which is in every receivership now you'll have a request to have this exemption apply. Is that the case?
No, Your Honor, it's not in every receivership. In this particular case, it's because there's a judgment and there's an execution of that judgment. So we're not saying it should apply to all receiverships. We're just saying in this particular situation, the excise tax exemption statute says upon execution of a judgment where there's an order of sale by the court. We have a judgment that's being executed on. The receiver is in place there to carry out that execution pursuant to order of the court, and the sale is approved by the court.
So you could have receiverships where it would be an order of the court to sell, but no judgment.
Yes, there's 40 different kinds of grounds for appointment of a receiver, and this is just one of them. This is one that fits into the exemption. Others may not.
Is there some advantage to having the court order a receivership rather than a writ of execution by the sheriff?
Well, there are some policy advantages and efficiencies in having a receiver because a receiver is appointed specially to deal with the property, can market the property more broadly, can control lots of different properties in different counties, and so
something the sheriff can't do.
It's something, right, exactly. Every sheriff is going to be county by county and generally property by property, but a receiver can take a broader view and maximize the value for creditors.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the court clearly saw the look on my face about the floodgates, and we are here because of that. The read of the statute is proposed, and I've tried to understand the 40 other receiverships that could or might be subject to exemption, but with the current read, the state could lose millions of dollars in tax, and that's why we're here. The readout statutorily of this general receivership would moot the definition of seller as being a taxable entity under the statute. And under statutory construction, we're supposed to harmonize all the existing provisions and to give them continued meaning. But the meaning I see ascribed here and in the court below would basically moot the seller ever being seller as receiver ever being taxable, no matter what exceptions are referred to, which are also outside the record. Insofar as receivership being like a form of execution, it's not. It's sui generis. It's not within the 6-point section. It's a special proceeding section. As admitted, the receiver is a fiduciary to the court and to a number of creditors, and the record below indicates the number of creditors, including a couple of prominent law firms who are creditors. So this is not in any way an execution where the sheriff appears. I'm sure each of you in your trials below actually were there to confirm when a sheriff sale occurred and dealing with the controversies that came with it. But if not, you know it's a very separate and different process. I didn't choose these four exemptions. The legislature did. Now, the legislature stands ready at the instance of any lobbying party. If there is a choice to be made and if there's a public policy to be reinforced, then so be it. They can lobby the legislature and say, you forgot to include receivers or general receiverships as an exempt transaction. Please do so. But for now, there are four ascribed statutory sections that are entitled to exemption, and the receivership is not in any way related to an execution upon judgment, and the court should reverse the trial court below.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes our calendar for today. We will be in recess. Thank you. All right.